trees, built roads, and were hitched like animals to plows. Some of them were also forced at gunpoint to search for and remove unexploded cluster bombs. "I know two people who were sent to seminar camps," Blei Yao Mo told me. "One of them, my wife and I asked him to lunch here in Merced. He don't want to eat. It is very strange because he was hungry for many years. One day when he was working in the camp, he sees a lizard. He picks it up very fast because if a guard sees you do that, he would hit you to death. He puts it in his pocket, and when no one is watching, he gets it out and eats it immediately. He's very happy. The lizard is fresh meat. He told me that story. That man, every day, he had to sign a confession accepting you are wrong by collaborating with the Americans. Every day his confession became better. After 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, that speech became part of himself. Before he was in that camp, he had a very strong personality. After 10 years, it changed him. The camp has completely broken his personality. While 2,000 or 3,000 Hmong were being re-educated in Pathet Lao camps, an exercise in coerced submission that violated the core of the Hmong temper, tens of thousands were able to respond to the new regime in more characteristic Hmong fashion, through armed rebellion. After Vang Pao's departure, former members of the Ahmé clandestine organized a resistance movement based on the Phu Bia Massif, the highest mountain range in Laos, south of the Plain of Jars. In late 1975, after the Pathet Lao forces attacked a group of Hmong, mostly women and children, who were working in Phu Bia field, Hmong rebels began a campaign of furious retaliation. Using weapons they had concealed in caves, they shot Pathet Lao soldiers, dynamited bridges, blocked roads, blew up food convoys, and just as many Hmong warriors in 1772 had rolled boulders on the heads of the Chinese army in eastern Quaychow, pushed rocks off cliffs while enemy troops were walking below. Although nearly 50,000 Hmong died, Phu Bia did not fall until 1978. Afterwards, Hmong guerrillas continued to live in the jungles along both sides of the Lao-Thai border, crossing back and forth between the two countries, launching irregular raids on the Lao People's Army. Most of the rebels belonged to a messianic group called Chao Fa, Lords of the Sky, led by Pakao Her, a former Vang Pao lieutenant who had broken ranks. Some belonged to Neo Horn, the United Laotian National Liberation Front, a group founded in the United States and headed by Vang Pao. Sporadic resistance by both groups, each of which has dwindled from thousands of guerrillas to 300 or 400, continues to this day, more than 2 decades after the war's official conclusion. The most widespread Hmong response to the terrors of post-war Laos, however, was migration, the same problem-solving strategy that had moved them from China for more than 3 million millennia, and then, starting at the beginning of the 19th century, had brought them to Laos. Most feared retribution, though some were motivated more immediately by famine, the consequence both of nationwide resource scarcity and of the increasing Hmong dependence toward the end of the war on American rice drops, handouts in resettlement sites, and soldiers' wages. For nearly 10,000 Hmong, there were no crops to harvest. Some of the Hmong who left because they were starving were later stigmatized as undeserving economic migrants rather than legitimate political refugees. In June of 1975, the Vientiane Domestic Service, the capital's official radio station, broadcast the government's interpretation of the mass Hmong decampment. With the collusion of the Thai reactionary clique, the U.S. imperialists have now forced the Mio tribesmen to flee from Laos into Thailand. The aim of such an evacuation is not based on the so-called humanitarian basis, but is to exploit their labor at cheap prices and to foster them as their henchmen so that they can be sent back to Laos to sabotage peace in this country in the future. Every Hmong refugee has an exodus story. In the hierarchy of good fortune, my interpreter Mei Ying Zhang and her family, along with the families of other military officers, airlifted from Long Tien, ranked at the top. All they had to do was leave behind every relative who did not belong to their immediate family, as well as virtually everything they owned, and overnight trade the high status they had enjoyed in Laos for a communal dormitory in a Thai refugee camp, where one bed was provided for a family of eight, and they stood in long lines for every meal, holding bowls for their rations of rice. "You were so lucky," I heard Nakao tell Mei Ying one night when they were comparing their post-war experiences. A notch further down, an option for only a few privileged families was escaping from Vientiane to another urban area by taxi, which meant forking over one's life savings to a Lao driver who, along with his passengers, might or might not be arrested before reaching the Thai border. Most Hmong walked. Some traveled in small extended family bands, others in convoys of up to 8,000 people. I never heard of a Hmong who fled alone. In the first months after the fall of Long Tien, when Pathet Lao efforts to block the Hmong Hegir were still disorganized, it was sometimes possible to drive one's livestock along major trails. "Those people could just kill their animals along the way so they didn't starve," Nakao told me. "They took it really easy." Later groups followed tiger and elephant trails or steered clear of established routes altogether, walking the ridgelines whenever they could in order to avoid mines and detection. Most families, like the Lees, took about a month to reach Thailand, though some lived in the forest for 2 years or more, moving constantly to evade capture, sleeping under bamboo leaves, subsisting on game, though that soon became scarce. Fruit, roots, bamboo shoots, the pith of trees, and insects. Desperate to fill their stomachs, some people chopped up their sweat-soaked clothes and mixed them with salt and water and ate them. They lit fires only at night so the smoke would not be visible. Sometimes they used foxfire, luminescent rotting wood, to light their way in the dark. Many people carried children on their backs. The babies presented a potentially fatal problem. They made noise. Silence was so essential that one Hmong woman, now living in Wisconsin, recalled that her son, who was a month old when the family left their home village, didn't know a single word when they arrived in Thailand 2 years later, because no one had talked during that entire period except in occasional whispers. Nearly every Hmong family I met in Merced had a story to tell about a baby. A relative's child, a neighbor's child, a member of the group they escaped with, who had been drugged with opium. "When the babies would cry," a young mother named Ye Tao Zhang told me, "we would mix the opium in water in a cup and give it to them so they would be quiet and the soldiers would not hear, because if they heard the babies, they would kill all of us. Usually the baby just went to sleep, but if you give too much by mistake, the baby dies. That happened many, many times." When I heard these stories, I recalled something I had once read about an Israeli child hiding from Palestinian terrorists who, when she began to cry, was accidentally smothered to death by her mother. That death, in 1979, was said to have driven the entire Israeli nation into mourning. The horror of the opium overdoses was not only that such things happened to the Hmong, but that they happened so frequently that far from driving a nation into mourning, they never made headlines, never caught the world's ear, never reached beyond a community of families that numbly accepted them as a fact of life. Sometimes worse things happened. When I asked Nakao about the boy with the scar on his forehead, whom Mei Li had mentioned in her eighth-grade essay, he said, "You had to be very quiet. The father of that little baby tried to kill him so he wouldn't cry and everyone would get killed. He had a slash on his head. Somebody saved him, and now he is living in Merced. Able-bodied adults usually took turns carrying the elderly, the sick, and the wounded, until they were no longer able to do so. At that point, a process of agonizing triage, the burdensome relatives were left by the side of the trail, usually with a little food and a little opium. People who died en route were left to rot. It was too dangerous to take time to bury them. To understand what these choices were like, it is important to remember that the Hmong revere their elders, and also that the soul of anyone who is not accorded the proper funerary rites, being washed, dressed in special clothes, and honored with animal sacrifices, verbally guided back to the place where one's placenta is buried, lamented with death drum and qing, and laid to rest in a hand-hewn coffin on the shoulder of a sloping mountain, is doomed to an eternity of restless wandering. Jonas Vangay said, "Not to bury the dead is terrible. Not to carry your relatives is terrible. It is the worst thing in the world to have the responsibility to choose between you and them." On their way to Thailand, Hmong families walked through abandoned villages and untended fields. They passed piles of jewelry, silver bars, and embroidered garments. Phu discarded her entire dowry of Phan Thao, which previous refugees had jettisoned. They also passed many decomposing corpses. Dang Mo, a Merced businessman whose family lived during their three-week journey on birds he shot with a homemade crossbow and poison-tipped bamboo arrows, saw dozens of ragged orphan children in the forest, eating leaves and dirt. He gave them food, but walked on past. His wife found a baby less than a year old, trying to nurse from the breast of its dead mother. They walked past it too. Because Hoi Soi was west of the Mekong River, the Lees were able to cross the Thai border on foot. Farther south, the Mekong, which is up to a mile wide, forms the Lao Thai boundary for more than 500 miles. Most Hmong refugees had to cross it. "The Mekong River is 10 times bigger than the Merced River," said Jonas Vangay. "So how do you cross?" "Most Hmong people do not swim. If you have money, maybe you can pay Lao for a boat. You can hold a tree branch. Bamboo floats better than wood, so you can lash it together. But later on, all the bamboo is gone because people have already cut it down, and you have to carry it all the way down from the mountains. Crossing this river, everyone here in the United States continue to dream of that nightmare." Some people attempted to float across the Mekong with bamboo stalks placed under their armpits on banana wood rafts or in inner tubes purchased from Lao traders. The inner tubes were hard to find and very expensive because the path at Lao Border Patrol killed people who sold them. Many babies and small children who had survived the journey this far drowned while crossing the river strapped to their parents' backs. Their bodies were left in the Mekong. A few Hmong refugees managed to bring empty plastic gallon containers. Still, others inflate ordinary grocery plastic bags, wrote Dominica Garcia, a doctor working in a Thai refugee camp, in a 1978 letter to the director of the International Rescue Committee. "It is not unusual to find these survivors clinging to their makeshift lifesavers even long after they have been in the detention centers. They carry them up to the hospital wards where they finally get proper treatment." One resident of Merced was 16 years old when he and his extended family reached the Mekong. They were able to obtain a boat large enough to hold half their party. He and another adult crossed the river first, bringing all the children. The other man paddled the boat back to the Lao side and picked up the rest of the adults. On the return trip, when the boat was halfway across the river, the border patrol sank the boat and fired on the passengers. From the Thai shore, the teenager and the children watched their parents, uncles, and aunts all die from bullets and drowning. Deng Mua's cousin, Mua Ki, once unsuccessfully tried to procure federal disability benefits for a mentally disturbed Hmong woman in Merced who, a decade earlier, had attempted to cross the Mekong with a party of 170 people. "They wait for the sun to go down and do a night crossing," he explained. "And then one group of Pathet Lao opened 3 machine gun. This lady, she saw more than 20 people fall down and die in one place, and one of them was her husband. I think she is sick now because maybe she saw too many trouble." One afternoon, when Blia Yao Mo and I were chatting, as we had on many previous occasions, I happened to make a casual remark about the cohesiveness of Hmong society. He said, "Yes, if a person outside the community see a Hmong person, they look that way. But inside, they have guilt. Many feelings of guilt. You go from the north of Laos, and then you go across the Mekong, and when the Pathet Lao soldiers fire, you do not think about your family, just yourself only. When you are on the other side, you will not be like what you were before you get through the Mekong. On the other side, you cannot say to your wife, 'I love you more than my life.' She saw. You cannot say that anymore. And when you try to restick this thing together, it is like putting glue on a broken glass." An unknowable fraction of the Hmong who attempted to flee Laos, some survivors estimate it was half, some much less, died en route, from Pathet Lao and Vietnamese bullets and mines, as well as from disease, starvation, exposure, snake bite, tiger maulings, poisoning by toxic plants, and drowning. Most of those who reached Thailand ended up often after being robbed and occasionally after being raped by Thai bandits in district police stations. From there, they were sent to refugee camps. When they arrived, 80% were found to be suffering from malnutrition, malaria, anemia, and infections, especially of the feet. At first, the Hmong were placed in a string of makeshift camps near the Lao border. Officially speaking, because Thailand had not signed the 1951 Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees, they were illegal immigrants. But the Thai government was willing to grant them temporary residence as long as other nations paid the bills and promised them permanent asylum. Eventually, most of the Hmong, who kept streaming across the Lao border until the early 1990s, were consolidated into one large camp in northeast Thailand, 15 miles south of the Mekong River. At its peak in 1986, the Ban Vi Nai camp had 42,858 inhabitants, of which about 90% were Hmong. It was the largest Hmong settlement in history, larger even than Long Tien, General Vang Pao's former military base. Ban Vi Nai was, in effect, a large-scale charitable institution that continued the job effectively begun by wartime rice drops of eroding Hmong self-sufficiency. Depending on how you looked at it, life there was either a catastrophic deracination or a useful dress rehearsal for life in the American inner cities to which many of its inhabitants would ultimately relocate. Though it lacked electricity, running water, and sewage disposal, the camp was so densely populated that it was, in effect, urban. A 1986 survey by a Catholic relief agency concluded, "Like other poor urban communities, Ban Vi Nai has problems of inadequate health, overcrowding, welfare dependency, unemployment, substance abuse, prostitution, and anomie, suicide, abandonment, loneliness." Jonas Vangay told me, "In Ban Vi Nai, you don't have the right to do anything except get a ration of rice and beans and go to your tent, and you do that for 5 or 10 years. People were born and grew up there. The young ones play soccer and volleyball. The elderly just sleep day and night. They just wait and see and wait and eat and wait and die and wait and die." According to Dwight Conkergood, The enthusiastic ethnographer from the International Rescue Committee who organized the Banvi Nai Rabies Parade, the camp officials tended to hold the Hmong responsible for their own dependence, poor health, and lack of cleanliness. Instead of seeing the Hmong as struggling within a constraining context of historical, political, and economic forces that have reduced them from proud independent mountain people to landless refugees, the Hmong are blamed for their miserable condition, he observed. Congregood was astonished at how violently most of the other Westerners at the camp disliked the Hmong, whom he liked very much. He wrote, I began to collect the phrases used regularly to describe the Hmong by agency officials who worked in Banvi Nai. The word I heard most often was filthy, followed closely by dirty, and often part of a cluster of terms that included scabies, abscesses, feces, and piles of garbage. A phrase regularly employed to cover a multitude of perceived sanitation sins was the following. They're one step out of the Stone Age, you know. A meaning-packed word heard about the Hmong almost every day was difficult, and its ramified derivatives, difficult to work with, the most difficult group, set in their ways, rigid, stubborn, you cannot get through to them, backward. One dedicated humanitarian agency employee who had worked with the Hmong for several years told me that the hand of God is on this place, but as for the Hmong living here, they're a fearful lot. You cannot work with them. Congregood believed that this focus on dirtiness and difficulty was actually an expression of Western expatriates' uneasiness when confronted with difference, the other. A Western aid official's encounter with the Hmong is a confrontation with radical difference in cosmology, worldview, ethos, texture of life. Unfortunately, as the French critic Tzvetan Todorov reminds us, the first spontaneous reaction with regard to the stranger is to imagine him as inferior, since he is different from us. Most of the people who made those disparaging comments about the Hmong came from the United States, to which the majority of the inhabitants of Banvi Nai eventually emigrated. About 10,000 Hmong resettled in France, Canada, Australia, Argentina, French Guiana, and elsewhere. But because of their American military ties and because Vang Pao had already established residence in Montana, they preferred the United States by a huge margin. In 1975, the U.S. was willing to admit fewer than 300 Hmong, mostly army officers and their families. But both the quotas and the eligibility requirements were liberalized over the years, with about 25,000 Hmong admitted in 1980 alone. As with Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees, the best educated Hmong and Lao came to America in the first wave of immigration and the least educated in later waves. Because for several years, the U.S. refused to accept extended family groups of more than 8 people, but did not limit the size of nuclear families. The Hmong, none of whom had birth certificates, grew accustomed to lying when they were interviewed by immigration officials. Second wives became daughters or sisters. Nieces and nephews became daughters and sons. According to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which supervised Banvi Nai, every refugee problem has 3 possible durable solutions. Local integration, voluntary repatriation, and resettlement in another country. Thailand, which was buffeted simultaneously by refugees from Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia, emphatically rejected the first solution. The Hmong emphatically rejected the second solution. In 1981, they also began to reject the third solution, leading Banvi Nai to become a kind of never-ending camp, or, as one U.S. refugee official termed it, a non-durable non-solution. In 1984, Eric E. Morris, the UN Deputy Refugee Representative in Thailand, said in bewilderment, "This is a unique situation historically. The Hmong are the first refugees we know who were offered resettlement and in large numbers simply turned it down. Some of them worried that the Hmong resistance movement in Laos, which was fueled by manpower and leadership in Ban Vi Nai, as well as by money funneled through the camp from refugees in the United States, would collapse if they left Asia. Most of them, however, had heard rumors about life in America from earlier immigrants and were just plain scared of tenements, of urban violence, of welfare dependence, of never being able to farm again, of being forbidden to sacrifice animals, of being thrown in jail if their godfathers smoked opium, of ogres, of dinosaurs, and, as they made clear during the notorious 1982 meeting on the Ban Vi Nai soccer field, of doctors who ate the livers, kidneys, and brains of Hmong patients. Ban Vi Nai started to look pretty good. It may have been dirty, crowded, and disease-ridden, but culturally, it was still powerfully Hmong. Women sewed pan dao, though some of them forsook the old motifs of elephant's feet and ram's horns for embroidered soldiers with bayonets. Men made jewelry, though when silver was unavailable, some of them melted down discarded aluminum cans. Many families raised chickens or tended small vegetable plots. Most compellingly, according to Dwight Conkergood, no matter where you go in the camp, at almost any hour of the day or night, you can simultaneously hear two or three performances, from simple storytelling and folk singing to elaborate collective ritual performances for the dead, including drumming, stylized lamentation, ritual chanting, manipulation of funerary artifacts, incense, fire, dancing, and animal sacrifice. Nearly every morning I was awakened before dawn by the drumming and ecstatic chanting of performing shamans. The older a Hmong was, the less willing he or she was to leave. At the camp, the cultural tradition was still there, Liao Mo told me. There was patrilineage. Children still listened to Grandpa. What is the good to go over there to America if all that change? And a lot of elderly people, though they never say it openly to strangers, what really haunt them is that they are afraid in America they will not have a good funeral ceremony and a good grave, and that is more important than any other thing in the world. Thailand closed Ban Vi Nai in 1992. Its 11,500 inhabitants were told they absolutely, positively had only two choices: to apply for resettlement in another country, or to return to Laos. As an interim measure, the resettlers were to move to one camp and the repatriators to another. Panic ensued. Hmong, who for more than a decade had resisted coming to the United States, now decided it was the safer of two abhorrent options, and then were rejected. With the support of the United States, where anti-immigrant sentiment was gathering steam, the Thai government and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees instituted a new and more stringent set of eligibility requirements under which nearly 2,000 Hmong applicants were denied refugee status. In 1991, about 7,000 Hmong have uneasily returned to Laos, persuaded that repressive conditions there have slackened. No more forced collectivization, no more seminar camps. Although those who repatriate in groups are assigned to lowland sites, may not return to their home villages, and may not practice slash-and-burn agriculture, at least their families, or so they have been assured, will no longer be in danger. There have been reports, however, all of them denied by the Laotian, Thai, and U.S. governments, and by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, that some Hmong have been forced by Thai authorities to return to Laos against their will, and once there, have been persecuted or killed. More than 10,000 Hmong, most of them inhabitants of Ban Vi Nai, simply said no to both choices and fled, whether temporarily or permanently, no one knows, to the sanctified grounds of Wat Tham Krabak, a Buddhist monastery north of Bangkok. Surrounded by coercive pressures on all sides, they managed to find a way out, as they had done so many times before during their intransient history, by moving in a direction none of their keepers could have predicted. Thai authorities have reported astonished that 10,000 Hmong had managed to slip through their fingers. They should have known better, for as long as there have been Hmong, there have been ways to get out of tight spots. In the greatest of all Hmong folk tales, Shi Yi, a healer and magician who was the forerunner of today's Xin Ning, was once ambushed by 9 evil Da brothers who ate human flesh and drank their blood. In the version collected by Charles Johnson, the brothers lay in wait for Shi Yi at a mountain crossroads where 9 paths led to every corner of the earth, and where the rocks looked like tigers and dragons. When the brothers transformed themselves into water buffaloes, so did Shi Yi. When they tossed him on their horns, he changed back into a man, and he chopped them into small pieces with his magical saber. When the pieces joined together and came back to life, he turned into a cloud and mounted high in the sky. When the brothers became a strong wind, Shi Yi became a drop of water. When one of the brothers became a leaf that would catch the drop of water, he became a deer, and he ran into the forest. The brothers became wolves, and they chased Shi Yi until the sun was low in the western sky, hanging at the edge of the earth. 8 of the brothers were too tired to go on, but the oldest one kept running. When Shi Yi saw an abandoned rat's burrow, he changed himself into a rat. The oldest brother turned into a cat and waited at the edge of the burrow. Shi Yi changed into a caterpillar with stinging fuzz, and the cat spat him back into the hole. As he waited in the hole, Shi Yi got angrier and angrier. When the cat fell asleep, Shi Yi turned himself into a very tiny red ant. Quickly and fiercely, he bit the cat on the testicle. Then he went home to his wife. Chapter 13. Code X. The night the Lees told me about their post-war experiences, I remember saying, because I did not know what to say, that must have been terrible. And Fu gave me a brief opaque look and said, yes, it was very sad. But when we were running from Laos, at least we hoped that our lives would be better. It was not as sad as after Leah went to Fresno and got sick. At first, I thought I had misunderstood her. In Laos, Fua and Nakao had lost 3 children in 3 years. They had dodged bullets, landmines, and walls of fire. They had left their village behind and then their country, knowing they would never see them again. How could anything, even the catastrophic illness of their favorite child, be worse than that? But I had not misunderstood her. Violence, starvation, destitution, exile, and death were, however horrific, within the sphere of known, or at least conceivable, tragedies. What had happened to Leah was outside that sphere. After 11 days in the pediatric intensive care unit at Valley Children's Hospital, Leah was transferred to MCMC by ambulance on December 5, 1986. She was examined by Dave Schneider, a second-year resident with a reputation for being brainy and nervous. In his examination note, Dave described Leah as a comatose, overweight Laotian girl, whose admitting diagnoses were 1. Severe hypoxic brain damage. 2. Pseudomonas septicema. 3. Severe seizure disorder. 4. Status post disseminated intravascular coagulation. 5. Status, post-septic shock. I was on a peds rotation, Dave recalled. And when I heard Lili was coming back from Fresno, basically brain dead, my heart sank. I didn't know the family very well, but I'd heard that they'd been non-compliant and difficult. Everyone had. I still have this vision of Leah when she got here, just lying in the bed and not looking anything like she used to. She was very hot and febrile. Her eyes were partially rolled back into her head, and she was breathing irregularly and way too fast. She had a lot of mucus and junk in her throat, but it was almost impossible to suction her because her jaw muscles were clamped shut. She wasn't making anything in the way of purposeful movements. Her legs were extended and her arms were alternating between being extended and flexed up to her chest, which is a sign of very weird and ominous stuff going on in the motor strip of the cerebral cortex. She did withdraw from painful stimuli, like when I squeezed tightly on her fingernail beds. Patients usually tell you to get the hell away when you do that. Leah couldn't tell me to go to hell, though on some level, I'm sure she wished I would. Leah was admitted to the pediatric unit. I remember the first time I went up to see her, said Peggy Philp. She was awful. Leah had been a real cute kid. I mean, she had had seizures, but she was so alive. And now she was just, well, there, but not peaceful and asleep-looking, like you might expect with a coma. I mean, it would be one thing if she laid there like Sleeping Beauty, all pretty and comfortable, but she didn't. She seemed to be in pain. She'd stiffen whenever you touched her. She was struggling. She made terrible, loud noises when she breathed. Peggy demonstrated with a torturous, rattling wheeze. And I kept thinking, God, she can't go on like this. This is exhausting her. She is going to wear herself out and die any minute. I remember being real angry at Hutch. Terry Hutchison, Leah's neurologist in Fresno. You know, God, you sent me this? When Peggy finished talking, I turned to Neil to ask what his impression had been. He shifted uneasily in his chair. Well, I didn't see her right away. I knew she'd been transferred back to our care to die. There she was, and that was what I had been afraid of. And I was just so, I mean, that episode in the emergency room burnt me out. It emotionally drained me, and facing Leah was real difficult for me at that point. So I took care of her, interjected Peggy. You did. I mean, you probably took care of her almost exclusively. I probably chose to avoid it a little bit. More than a little bit, I chose to avoid it. I have to admit, I bailed out. It took Neil 3 days walking past Leah's room innumerable times before he could bring himself to look at the patient who had dominated his professional life and his private thoughts for much of 4 years. I asked him what he found when he finally saw her. She was in a vegetative state. But that was one angry vegetable. Calling Leah a vegetable was, it seemed to me, just one more form of avoidance. In describing what had happened to her, he and Peggy both used the kind of terms favored by the doctors in MASH. Gallows humor, slang wielded in times of extreme stress on the theory that if you laugh at something, it can't break your heart. Leah got gorked. She crumped. She fried her brain. She vegged out. She crapped out. She went to hell. No one's at home. The lights are out. The first nurse's note after Leah's admission read, pulse rate fast at 130 and has a temp of 102. Offers no recognition or acknowledgement. NG tube in place. Then, without comment, family in room and shaman performing a ceremony. When I asked Gloria Rodriguez, Leah's nurse during that shift, about that note, she said, Oh, yeah, they had a medicine man come in. He brought some kind of white ointment, and they chanted and rubbed it all over Leah. It smelled like vodka and herbs. I remember her mom wouldn't let us give her a bath because that would take off the white stuff. In any case, Fo preferred to care for her daughter herself. She sat by Leah's bed around the clock. Mother encouraged to hold child while linens changed, noted a nurse. Mother stroking and chanting to child. The nurses showed her how to apply Vaseline to Leah's cracked lips, rub Desitin on her diaper rash, cool her forehead with a moist washcloth, suction her secretions, and feed her formula through the nasogastric tube. Once, Fo and Nakao brought in an herbal remedy. A thick, stringy, gooey, gross, green liquid, as Peggy remembered it, and tried to feed it to Leah. When they realized Leah couldn't swallow, they decided to pour it down the nasogastric tube, and Peggy, certain Leah would die anyway, instructed the nurses to let them do so. The Hmong New Year, a multi-day holiday that is traditionally celebrated in the 12th month of the year, started at first cock crow on the first day of the waxing moon. Happened to fall during Leah's stay at MCMC. It is the most important and merriest holiday of the Hmong year. A time to banish harmful das and ask for assistance of benevolent household spirits. Summon home the souls of dead ancestors and, in general, secure good fortune for the coming year. It is also a time to dance, sing, play courting games, and dress in embroidered finery, which, even in America, many Hmong women start sewing months in advance. It is thought that anyone who wears old clothes at the New Year's will bring poverty to the family. That year, Fo had made new pantao for all her daughters using Thai cloth, worked with American thread, and decorated with antique Indo-Chinese coins. She showed these garments to me once. Leah's skirt was by far the fanciest, with embroidered stripes of pink and green and black and pleats so numerous and fine they looked like the gills of a mushroom. "These are the cloths Leah was going to wear," she told me. "These were the most beautiful cloths because we loved her so much. No one else is allowed to wear them because they are Leah's and only Leah's. I made them because I thought Leah was going to be up and running around our house at New Year's. But she got sick instead, so she didn't wear them. And it was the only time in our lives that we ever missed the New Year's celebration." Mei Li said, "We didn't do anything at New Year's, not even the soul-calling ceremony, because the doctors told us Leah was going to die and my family was just crying all the time." Instead, Fo brought a different set of clothes to the hospital, funeral garments. "It is Hmong culture to do that," explained Nakao. "For us Hmong, if you don't dress them up, then after they pass away, you always dream of them being naked. It is not really good to see a person naked, so we dressed them in special clothes. Leah's mother sewed them for her. The special clothes were a black hat, a black jacket, and a high-waisted appliqué skirt. The nurses told Fo that Leah couldn't actually wear the jacket since they needed access to her upper body. So at first, Fo laid it over her daughter's hospital gown. Later, when the nurses were out of the room, she disobeyed instructions and dressed Leah properly. Leah's room was always crowded with siblings, cousins, uncles, aunts, and members of the Li and Yang clans who traveled from out of town to join what one nurse's note called the vigil. Though some nurses did their best to be sympathetic, most were exasperated by the unremitting commotion. "Those people could all yak and raise their voices and gesticulate at each other," recalled a nurse named Evelyn Marciel. "They were totally fed up with us. They'd ask us what we were doing, why we were doing it. There wasn't a question asked that hadn't been answered 10 times over. Anything we were doing was wrong." Dee Korda also came frequently. Peggy remembers her sitting next to the bed crying, and Janine Hilt was there every day. "There was usually no interpreter," Janine recalled. "But you know, Fo and I communicated more through the soul anyway. We held each other a lot. When someone was there to translate, Four and Nakao always talked about how much they loved Leah and how special she was to them. I told them how special she was to me, too. The only thing I was thankful for is that it had not happened at the foster home. That had been my worst fear, that she would have a massive seizure in foster care. God, it could have happened so easily, and if it had, they would have blamed me forever. It would have had ramifications throughout the Hmong community. CPS steals children and they die. On Leah's second day back at MCMC, Nakao demanded that Leah's subclavian line, a central intravenous line placed with great difficulty at Valley Children's Hospital, be removed and all her medications discontinued. Peggy noted in Leah's progress record, I held a long discussion with both parents through aid of an interpreter. CPS worker Janine Hilt was present. Parents understand that the antibiotics are fighting a severe infection and that without medication, Leah may get her infection back and die sooner. They understand that once we remove IV, a new line will not be replaced. They understand and still refuse medication. Therefore, meds and IV will be withdrawn. The impression I had, recalled Peggy, was that they wanted Leah to be peaceful and not be persecuted anymore. Basically, they wanted her to die with dignity. Peggy was mistaken. She thought that Pho and Nakao wanted to withdraw the medicines because they were artificially prolonging Leah's life. In fact, though the Lees believed that Leah was so sick she might die, they wanted to stop treatment because they thought it was the medicines that were killing her. After the IV line was taken out, Pho and Nakao announced that they wanted to take Leah home. Her brain damage had fouled up the homeostatic mechanisms that regulated her body temperature, and she was spiking fevers as high as 107.4 degrees, which is potentially fatal. Peggy therefore informed the Lees that Leah needed to stay at MCMC for a few days of observation. I was sure she was dying, she recalled. But that's the quandary of Western medicine, that you can't let people die. Concerned that Leah be kept comfortable during her final days, Janine wrote the following memo. To Ernst, Philp, from Hilt, regarding Leah going home. Before we let Leah go home, let's reevaluate the family's desire to do this. Are they physically, emotionally, and financially able to take this on? Do they have a bed, linen, prescribed food, stethoscope, pampers, etc., etc. on hand? They must have all this plus home health nursing in place before I am ready to say okay. Are you convinced that they can feed Leah properly? Have they accurately demonstrated their understanding and skill? Will they feed her every 4 hours? By December 9th, Janine and Peggy had arranged for home nursing visits and for all the necessary supplies, including a suction machine to clear Leah's secretions and, as Dave Schneider noted, a large supply of diapers as child is incontinent and presently having diarrhea. A nurse wrote the following discharge instructions. 1. Glass Rock Health Services will be by at 8 p.m. tonight. Give them prescription. 2. Make sure to come to clinic this Thursday, December 11th at 8 a.m. 3. Keep egg crate mattress pad on at all times. 4. Turn her every 2 hours so she does not get infected bed sores. 5. Suction her as often as necessary. Diet instructions. Feed formula every 4 hours during daytime. 5 feedings a day. 10 ounces, 5 times a day. All foods or medicines must go down tube. Pho didn't understand the instructions and in any case had no intention of giving Leah medicines or anything else through a nasogastric tube, which was intended to circumvent Leah's impaired sucking and gag reflexes and keep food from going down her trachea. Nonetheless, she signed the line that read, These instructions have been explained to me and I understand them. Her signature, just as it had been when she signed the discharge papers after Leah's birth at MCMC 4.5 years earlier, was the single word, Fu Yang. At some point that day, Nikau was also asked to sign something. It is not included in Leah's chart, so no one knows exactly what it was, although it probably had to do with the Lee's decision to withdraw her from MCMC. It is likely that Nikau was told that in 2 hours, after the discharge paperwork was completed, she would be released and he could take her home to die. His interpretation was somewhat different. He recalled, "One person gives Leah medicine." This was probably Tylenol for her fever, which the nurse's notes indicate that father refused. "And then another person comes and has a paper on a clipboard and makes me sign and says that in 2 hours, Leah is going to die. They weren't fixing her. I thought even if they fix her, she is going to die here. And if they don't fix her, she is going to die here. So I might as well just bring her home right now so the older children can see her. I am not satisfied. I'm very disappointed at the hospital. I am mad. Is this a hospital that fixes people or makes them die?" This was not the first time in the last 2 weeks that the Lees had been told Leah would die, but for some reason, perhaps because Nikau believed it contained such a time-specific prediction, it was the most offensive. In the Hmong moral code, foretelling a death is strongly taboo. It is an unpardonable insult to say to one's aged grandparent, "After you are dead." Instead, one says, "When your children are 120 years old." I asked several Hmong people I knew how they would feel if a doctor told them their child was going to die. "A doctor should never say that," exclaimed Chong Mua, a mother of three. "It makes the da come closer to the child. It is like saying, 'Okay, okay, take her.'" Kua Her, an interpreter for the health department, said, "In Laos, that means you're going to kill a person. Maybe poison him, because how do you know for certain he's going to die unless you are going to kill him?" One night, I told Bill Selvage that the Lees had perceived the doctor's comments not as candid prognosis, but as threats. "I'm not surprised," he said. "All those verb tenses. Leah will die. Leah might die. Leah has a 95% chance of dying." Those nuances would be very confusing through an interpreter. And if the parents thought that people at MCMC were saying Leah should die, maybe they were right. I imagine there were a lot of people here who thought that if Leah was comatose and couldn't communicate, and the only sensation she could feel was pain, it would be better for her if she did die. When Nikau thought he was being forced to sign a piece of paper that said his daughter was going to die in 2 hours, he did what any Hmong in an impossible corner, starting with the legendary Shi Yi, might consider doing. He fled. He grabbed Leah, who was dressed in her funeral clothes, from her bed in the third-floor pediatric unit and started running down the stairs. One of the nurses called a code X. Every hospital has a set of emergency codes that are blared over the public address system. Code blue for dying patient in need of resuscitation. Code red for fire. Code X for security breaches. Nikau recalled, "They were chasing after me. They called two policemen, hospital security guards, and they wanted me to go back to the hospital. When they called the police, the lady that told me that Leah was going to die came to scold me and said, 'What are you doing?' At that time, I was so angry, I pushed that nurse and her head went blah." Dave Schneider was paged, stat, that is, urgently and immediately. It was late Friday afternoon at the end of what had already been a bad week for him, and it was about to get worse. Exhausted by the stresses of being a resident, the 33-hour shifts, the constant hectoring of resentful patients, the fear of making a fatal mistake, Dave had requested a 3-month leave of absence from MCMC and had only a few days, which he had hoped would be calm before he left. I was about as low as I had ever been in my entire life, he told me. And I was in no state to put up with any bullshit from a father, whether he was a caring, concerned father who had customs that were different from mine or not. I mean, I really was not particularly feeling like having a discussion with him about cultural differences. When Dave arrived, at a run on the pediatric floor, the security guards had already escorted Nakao and Leah back to her room. They'd found this Laotian guy carrying out this basically motionless child, and when I got there, they and the nurses were yelling at him in a language he didn't understand. I didn't yell at him, but I was very angry. What really pissed me off is that he had pulled out her NG tube. He denied it, but it had been thrown onto the stairs. Obviously, they wanted to take Leah home and let her die, and we were willing to do that, but it had to be done in a medically acceptable manner, not by starving her to death, which was what would happen if she didn't have the NG tube. So we'd instructed them as to how to use it and everything. Then the father rips her off, runs down the stairs, and takes out the tube. I mean, they had minutes to go, or at most an hour or two, before we were going to let them take her home anyway, but they just couldn't fucking wait. In a sharp voice, Dave told Nakao over and over again that if he'd been patient, Leah could have left soon, but now she couldn't, because the nasogastric tube had to be reinserted and then x-rayed to confirm its position. In fact, the new tube was inserted incorrectly, and it had to be repositioned and x-rayed a second time. This, plus the paperwork, took nearly 4 hours. The hospital staff, including the nurse Nakao had pushed against the wall, she hadn't been hurt, went about their business as if the incident, which they later referred to as the abduction, were an everyday event. Though they were all furious, no one considered reporting Nakao for assault or preventing him at what they decided was the appropriate time from taking his daughter home. Leah left MCMC at 10:15 p.m. in her mother's arms. At the time of her discharge, her temperature was 104 degrees. Her parents carried her back to their apartment, took off her funeral clothes, and laid her on a shower curtain they had spread on the living room floor. Leah was going to die if she stayed in the hospital, said Nakao. But we boiled up some herbs and we washed her body. At the hospital, she was so sick that when she was sleeping on the bed, she sweated so much her bed got all wet. She had too much medicine and her body just gave way. But then we boiled the herbs and we washed her and her sweat stopped and she didn't die. Chapter 14 Melting Pot. The Lee family, Nakao, Fu, Chong, Zuo, Chang, Mei, Yer, and True, arrived in the United States on December 18, 1980. Their luggage consisted of a few clothes, a blue blanket, a wooden mortar and pestle that Fo had chiseled from a block of wood in Hoi Soi. They flew from Bangkok to Honolulu, then to Portland, Oregon, where they were to spend 2 years before moving to Merced. Other refugees told me that their airplane flights, a mode of travel that strained the limits of the familiar Hmong concept of migration, had been fraught with anxiety and shame. They got airsick. They didn't know how to use the bathroom, but were afraid to soil themselves. They thought they had to pay for their food, but had no money. They tried to eat the wash and dress. The Lees, though perplexed, took the novelties of the trip in stride. Nakao remembers the airplane as being just like a big house. Their first week in Portland was miserably disorienting. Before being placed by a local refugee agency in a small rented house, they spent a week with relatives sleeping on the floor. We didn't know anything, so our relatives had to show us everything, Fo said. They knew because they had lived in America for 3 or 4 months already. Our relatives told us about electricity and said the children shouldn't touch those plugs in the wall because they could get hurt. They told us that the refrigerator is a cold box where you could put meat. They showed us how to open the TV so we could see it. We had never seen a toilet before, and we thought maybe the water in it was to drink or cook with. Then our relatives told us what it was, and we didn't know whether we should sit or whether we should stand on it. Our relatives took us to the store, but we didn't know that the cans and packages had food in them. We could tell what the meat was, but the chickens and cows and pigs were all cut up in little pieces and had plastic.